10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
I am excited about the opportunity we have today to talk about one of the oddest, maybe creepiest, maybe most wondrous creatures on the earth, the eel. The book at hand is called Slippery Beast, a true crime natural history with eels. I hope you are as intrigued by that title as I was. And the author of the book, Ellen Ruppelschell, is already responsible for several really interesting books, including one that I have only read in part, but am excited at some point to finish, called Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. She has also written The Job, Work and Its Future in a Time of Radical Change, The Hungry Gene, The Science of Fat and the Future of Thin, and A Child's Place, A Year in the Life of a Daycare Center. In this particular instance, Ellen Ruppelschell is talking about one of the most mysterious and intriguing of all living things, and also talking about sort of the troubling way in which human beings have messed with eels and driven them nearly to extinction and have engaged in all kinds of very, very shady operations and practices in order to harvest eels in ever-escalating numbers. It's a fascinating story. It crossed her path in somewhat surprising fashion, and I'm so glad it did, because the result of it is this fascinating book. You have perhaps seen her writing in places like Scientific American, Smithsonian, The New York Times, The Washington Post. She is a professor emeritus of science journalism at Boston University, and was a longtime contributing editor to The Atlantic. This latest book is published by Abrams Press. And Ellen Ruppelschell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
I'm excited for us to have this conversation. Ahead of us talking about your book, Slippery Beast, I wonder if we could just hear a little bit about this intriguing career that you've had as a writer, and the plethora of fascinating topics that you have written about over the years. Could you say a word about how you got interested in writing, and this kind of exploratory writing in particular?
Yeah, well, we're going way back here. I did study biology at university, and was always fascinated by the natural world. But at the same time, I was also really interested in the written word, right? So those two came together for me many, many years ago, and I'm particularly interested in issues that intersect science, the human condition, and social justice. All those things come together in The Slippery Beast, believe it or not. The other thing that I'm interested in is economics as it applies to everyday humans, right? So I'm not an economist, but my last two books did deal with economics. And interestingly, Slippery Beast does as well.
Mm, it sure does. I also want to ask you real quick about the field of science journalism. You are a professor emeritus of science journalism at Boston University. Beyond the obvious, I mean, we all know what science is to some extent and what journalism is to some extent. But what about when you put those two together in a particular academic discipline? What are you teaching or exploring when you are talking about science journalism?
Well, I think we all know, especially given current events over the last decade, how important it is to have a general public understanding of science, right? Evidence, the scientific method, these basic things, using logic, kinds of things that, we should all have. In fact, I feel just these kinds of basic statistics, basic understandings of evidence-based fact should probably be taught, starting in elementary school. My students, I taught graduate students, all had at least one degree in science, and their interest was to leverage that degree and their understanding of science to write beautifully or produce wonderfully on issues in science, medicine, engineering. And that's pretty much what I did and what my students continue to do.
Hmm. Well, you've certainly done a wonderful job with that in your book, Slippery Beast, A True Crime Natural History with Eels. The story of how you, in a sense, stumbled upon this particular story is really both interesting and intriguing. It has something to do with the fact that you typically spend part of the year in the beautiful state of Maine. Tell our listeners about the encounter that you and your husband had with someone who ended up sort of opening the door to this fascinating story for you.
Yeah, so this is years ago, about a decade ago. This is how long I've been contemplating this project. About a decade ago, a gentleman who I call Sam in the book, and for various reasons, his real name will remain nameless, was a person who we hired to help us fix up a home that we had bought on the coast of Maine. Help us because we were not able to do all the repairs that were needed to be done on this, fixer-upper of a home about a mile from the ocean. And Sam, claimed to be a wonder with power tools, but if that were true, that his wonders ceased with us because Sam would often come late, sometimes would not come at all. And when he did come, would frequently quit early, and sometimes he'd pad into my kitchen with a four-pack of cider, Maniac cider, the kind of cider they sell in Maine. He'd pop a can and sit down, and we'd talk. And I have to admit, I was a sucker for Sam, and he told great stories. So I'd pop a can, too. We'd sit down, and he'd tell me stories about his family and especially about his grandson, who he adored. And Sam's grandson was, as I said, the light of his life. And so he taught him to play t-ball, and he taught him to play horseshoes. He was a champion horseshoe player. And he wanted to teach him how to fish. But to do that, he had to put together enough money to buy a boat. And that's part of the reason he was working as a handyman for us. Well, it seemed to me that, he didn't love working as a handyman, and so I suggested to him that he mix business and pleasure and get a commercial fishing license to go with that boat, because so many people on the coast of Maine do that, and why not? And Sam said, well, I could do that. In fact, I did do that, but not anymore because of the eels. Bingo, right? The eel. So I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And he said, well, the eels. And I said, I really have no idea. He said, really? He said, yes. I said, what is it with eels? Are you afraid of them? And he said, no, I'm not afraid of them. Eels don't bite, as far as I know. But I'm not talking about big eels. I'm talking about the baby eels. Baby eels... the price of which, as it turned out, had gone through the roof in recent years at that time. And I said, well, what do you mean the price has gone through the roof? And he said, well, lobster maybe goes for $10 a pound. baby eels go for $2,500 a pound. And with money like that, things have gotten pretty rough on the river. People have guns. They cut each other's nets. It's gotten too dangerous, and I want no part of the eels. So, as you can imagine, after hearing that story, and there's more to it, I was very, very intrigued by this question of the eels of Maine, and it took me a few years, because I was working on some other projects, to get to this project, but honestly, I couldn't wait to find out what the story was behind $2,500 a pound eels.
Right, exactly. By the way, you actually, ahead of the encounter with Sam, tell the story of encountering somebody else named Jill, and this was, I think, years earlier than this conversation you just described with Sam. And the topic of eels comes up with her as well, although I don't think with any of this sort of darker connotation. But so the conversation with Sam ends up being kind of the second time someone had mentioned the eels of Maine. Can you just remind me about that first conversation?
Sure. Well, Jill, that is her first name. I encountered right after we bought our house in Maine. So this is quite a while ago. And she came to our house unbidden, hadn't invited her. I recognized her because I'd seen her walking the road with her dog, but we'd never met. And when she came to my door, I let her in, and I offered her coffee, and she said, no, this is not a social visit. And as it turned out, it was kind of a mission of mercy, right? This is why Jill had come down, and she wanted to warn us of all sorts of bad things that happened in Midcoast Maine. And she told us about, the drug dealers and the dangerous owls that preyed on cats and one thing after another. And I batted each one of these things back. And then she said, looked out at our little lake that's behind our house. And he said, well, that lake is full of eels. And again, I had no idea that the lake we had, that we just bought this house on, had eels in it. And this was what, as I mentioned in the book, we never saw one after she left. As it turns out, eels are nocturnal, and you're not likely to see one unless you're skinny dipping at night with a flashlight. which I can't say I've never done, but, so I'd never spotted an eel, and I didn't quite believe there were eels on our pond. We call them ponds in Maine, maybe a lake in Wisconsin. But in any case, I'd never spotted one and didn't really worry about it, didn't really think about it again until it was probably at least 10 years later that we met Sam. Mm.
Well, and it's a good thing you did, because, of course, otherwise you never would have gone on this remarkable voyage of exploration, if you will. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ellen Ruppel-Schell about her latest book, which is called Slippery Beast, A True Crime Natural History with Eels. It sounds like at the outset you knew rather little about eels. And, of course, by the end of this exploration, you knew a whole lot more than most of us about this intriguing creature. Let's get a few basics out of the way. First of all, tell us where eels live and just what a large family of creatures, in fact, they are.
Well, okay. Let's start by saying that there are over 820 different species of eels around the world, okay? The species that I talk about in this book is the American eel. I also refer to the European eel. They're very closely related. You wouldn't be able to tell those two apart. So as you can imagine, the European eel is what we associate with Europe, and the American eel is what we associate with mostly Canada and the United States, although it's also in the Caribbean. Okay, so those are the two kinds of eels that I focus in the book. Those The Japanese eel, these three varieties, are the most commercially viable eels, the ones that we think of. If you ever think of eel, you're probably thinking of the Japanese ale, the European ale, or the American ale. Okay. Mm-hmm. So these eels were at one time so common. The American eel and the European eel at one point, not that long ago, in the 1970s, constituted about 50% of the biomass in rivers, lakes, waterways in both Europe and the United States. Okay? They were that common. And, you know, for example, in your Lake Superior in Wisconsin, there are and have been American eels. Okay? So even though we associate them with the East Coast in the United States, they do swim up rivers into the Midwestern states and find their ways to lakes, rivers, settle in on the ponds, lakes, rivers, everywhere east of the Mississippi in the U.S. That's to give you some idea of how ubiquitous eels are. Now, what's happened since the 1970s, if they have declined radically, okay, in number. So in Europe, they're down, it's hard to estimate, of course, but they're down about anywhere from 90% to 95%, okay? And they are an endangered species, a critically endangered species in Europe. In the United States, Canada, they're down, the American eel is down about 50%. It's not classified, not officially classified as an endangered species, and a lot of scientists and fish advocates are very, very worried about that.
Hmm. With good reason, I'm sure. You tell us at some point in the book about your very first time tasting wild eel. And this was, if I remember correctly, while you were visiting a friend in Bergen, Norway. And tell our listeners a little bit about this and also what it was like to eat this this wild eel. You're a little bit cagey on whether or not you even liked it at all, but clearly it was a memorable culinary experience for you.
It was a memorable experience, and it was in Bergen, on the west coast of Norway. I was there to visit a scientist. Her name is Carolyn de Ruff, an amazing eel scientist in Norway. And Carolyn was kind enough to put me up for the night and to cook me dinner with her husband. And among the things she cooked was she presented me with was a smoked eel that had been caught by a local fisherman, a wild eel. And yeah, like many of us, I think, we first taste wild eel, and it's hard to find in the United States actual wild eel. Unless you catch it yourself, you're very unlikely to have tried it. If you have not caught it yourself or had a friend who caught it, you are very unlikely to have tried it, because most of the eel we eat in the United States is cultivated eel. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But anyway, Carolyn's eel, it was so kind of her to cook it for me, or present it to me, get a hold of it for me. But to be perfectly honest, I used a napkin and sequestered the eel in the napkin and hid it under the table because I had a really hard time getting it down. Again, this was wild eel, not cultivated eel.
Right.
Like many people, I very much like cultivated eel, the kind that you get in the U.S. you would get in a sushi restaurant, as unagi.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I was thrilled to partake in what I imagined would taste like a cross of lobster and chicken. One bite disabused me of that fantasy. The soapy flavor and wet dish rag texture are difficult to compare with other foods I've tasted. But let's just say that neither chicken nor lobster came to mind. It's
right.
It's like we're there.
Thank you. Well, I'm sorry to put you there.
Right, exactly. Right above that paragraph happens to be an interesting, very old illustration. It looks like it maybe comes from a children's book or something, but it's kind of an old maybe woodcut or etching or something. But it shows a child buying an eel from a street vendor. And just in that caption alone, we learn a lot about just how popular once upon a time eels were. And of course, you know, part of the point of your story is the rebound of eels as of culinary interest. But tell our listeners about the way in which the eel was a very significant part of many people's menus in centuries past.
Oh, yes. I mean, obviously, we have, in terms of written record, we have more in Europe than we do in North America. There's oral tradition in North America with Native Americans. In Europe, we have more of a written record. And in the written record, we see that eel eating goes back, obviously, to the ancients, right? The ancients, the Egyptians worshipped eels, as they did many things, of course. The Romans had this great affinity for eels to the point that some of them, I know this sounds very neurotic, adopted them as pets. And there's some evidence that they would doll them up with eel jewelry. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
Then as we go through the ages, eels were a very, very important food source, particularly the Dutch and in London, in England. They, both those places, the British or the Englanders would import eel from Holland in what were called eel boats. And they would come, their whole, you know, what do you call the bottom part of a boat? I'm not a boater, but would be filled with water and filled with eels, because eel, again, was a very popular food in England, as it was in Holland. In England, they would maybe pickle or jelly it. In Holland, they would more typically smoke it. But eel is, you know, popular in many, many parts of the world. Japan now eats about 70% of the eel that's produced commercially. So the Japanese, of course, have a great affection for the eel. And in the United States, believe it or not, we used to, eel was a very popular food, first with Native Americans. Of course, the maritime Native Americans relied on it heavily to sustain them through the winters because they could preserve it. They could smoke it and salt it and preserve it. But also the settlers, the colonists, wrote, you know, rhapsodized about the American eel, which they found absolutely delicious. And this, you know, eel eating went on. Eels were more popular than lobsters in the late 1800s and early 1900s in the United States. And then with the coming of the progressive era around the turn of the last century, it started to fall out of favor, in part because any food that had to be hunted in the wild, which it was at that time, kind of fell out of favor with the middle class. You know, rich people would maybe go and hunt and get, you know, or participate in these recreational hunts, and poor people would do that as well, obviously. But the vast middle class kind of turned away from this kind of food that required a lot of work to get and a lot of work to prepare. Eels are not easy to catch, and they are a bear to prepare. They're difficult to prepare, yeah. So they fell out of favor until the sushi craze, which I trace the sushi, you know, sushi kind of 1920s, then went away, and then came back in the 1960s and has only gotten more popular ever since. And sushi, which is, eel, which is always served cooked, is kind of a gateway drug to sushi for some people, right? They get to eat the cooked eel, and it tastes pretty good. And believe it or not, that empowers them, or, you know, makes them feel it's okay to eat raw fish in the form of sushi. So since the introduction of sushi and the popularity of sushi, eel has become much more popular in the United States.
Fascinating.
And we now import about 11 million pounds of it a year, so quite a bit.
What would be selling points in terms of consuming eel? I mean, is it healthy for us to eat? Certainly, your book talks about in the past how it was believed to accentuate certain qualities if one consumed eel. And of course, now scientifically, maybe we know a little bit more about the actual facts of such a thing. But are there benefits to eating eel, either mythical or factual?
Well, you can imagine the eel is a very phallic animal, and so you can imagine. I'm just going to come out and say that. You can imagine what people thought, that it would increase human potency, right? Of course, there's no evidence of that, but it's a nice way to think about it. But in fact, eel is incredibly nutritious. Okay, but let me contextualize that. So eel has a lot of vitamin A, for example, and it is very fatty fish, you know, the kind of good fat that we're supposed to eat, fish fat. So it's a very nutritious food, okay? Unfortunately, because of all that fat, and because they burrow in the mud, you know, they're nocturnal animals. During the day, they burrow in the mud. Whatever's in that mud, whatever's in that water, any kind of pollution bioaccumulates in the eel. And this is why wild eel it can be sketchy, okay? Mm. Eating wild eel, you know, unless you're talking about a pristine natural environment, and there aren't that many of those left, you have to remember that an eel can hide out in a waterway. Female eel can hide out for 30 or 40 years, and those elements can accumulate in the flesh of that eel and the fat of that eel. So it is not necessarily recommended that people eat wild eel. And even the eel I ate off the coast of Norway was most likely polluted by those elements. And that's why, in part, why cultivated eel tastes so much better. That is farmed eel, okay? And again, most of the eel that we eat in the United States is farmed.
Hmm. We need to turn for a moment to what will probably be one of the bigger surprises in your book, Slippery Beast, A True Crime Natural History with Eels, Chapter 4, in which we read about the involvement, if you will, of Sigmund Freud in our evolving understanding of the eel. That was something I did not see coming as I began reading your endlessly fascinating book. Tell our listeners about the intersection between Sigmund Freud and the eel.
That is such a fun story. I could have written a whole book about Freud and the eel. I mean, talk about the Oedipus complex, right? I mean, it's just remarkable. But I'll begin by saying that scientists since Aristotle have been fascinated by the eel. It's been the center of so many scientific controversies. And the reason for that is because no one had ever seen, and to this day, no one has ever seen an eel in the open ocean, okay, an American eel or European eel in the open ocean, nor have they ever found an eel egg, okay? So this whole question of eel reproduction and life cycle has been this great mystery. It's called the eel problem that has haunted scientists and natural historians for thousands of years. I mean, it's really an incredible story that I was able to, you know, go around the world and talk to scientists about. And I have to tell you, once you get bit by the eel, you know, curiosity, it's hard to get rid of it. I mean, it's very, very absorbing. It becomes an obsession for many people.
Interrupt for just 1 second. What you just said reminds me of a fun moment from the end of Chapter 5 when you talk about a German scientist on his deathbed confessing that everything was known to science with the notable exception of the eel question. I mean, so it has been the bane of so many scientists.
It is. It's just unbelievable. And to this day, you know, I read about the modern Captain Ahab of eels. But in any case, so let's get back to Freud. So many of us think of Freud, of course, rightfully, the father of psychoanalysis. you know, that's what we think of when we think of Freud. But Freud was, when he was a young man, was very interested in the in animals, and especially, you know, the nervous system of fish. So as a medical student, he worked with a scientist. His name was Karl Klaus, a famous scientist in Vienna, and he was his student. Karl Klaus was his advisor, and Karl Klaus was a buddy of Darwin's and a big fan of Darwin, a Darwinist. And Darwinist is one of the millions, not millions exaggeration, but the many, many scientists who thought about eels. And what Darwin thought about it, the eel, was that it was a hermaphrodite, that it had both male and female sexual organs. And there was a reason he believed that, and he, you know, Karl Klaus wanted to believe that, you know, because Darwin believed that. In part, okay. I Karl Klaus is long dead, so I couldn't ask him, but that's what it seemed when you read the literature on this. So Klaus, at that point, they had located the female sexual organ in eels, in some eels, but they had never found a male sexual organ. So what Klaus wanted was to find both those things in the same eel to kind of prove the theory that eels were hermaphrodites. But Klaus was a really big deal. He was a very senior scientist, and he wasn't going to find this out for himself. So he had a student who happened to be Sigmund Freud go to Trieste, which is, it has a harbor, it's in Italy, and get eel after eel and cut them open and look to see if he could find the hermaphroditic eel. Okay, so that is, he wanted to find a male organ and a female organ in the same mature eel. Okay, that is, you know, sexually mature eel. So Freud proceeded to go to Trieste dutifully. He's an ambitious young man. He also was excited to go to the Italian coast, and he did, you know, free trip. And he spent weeks, and some people think months, disemboweling eel after eel, looking for this. And it was a big mess, and he wrote about it to a dear friend of his, and his letters are hysterical. He illustrates them with little eels that look like Mona Lisa smiles on their face. I mean, very, very funny. And he's very full of himself. You know, he's 20 years old. He's very cocky, and he says snarky things about other scientists. It's, anybody who wants to have a good time should read what Freud was, you know, writing at that time. And he, you know, opened up eel after eel. You can just imagine what a mess this was. And after weeks and weeks and 400 eels, he finally found a tiny male sex organ in an eel in the absence of a female organ. So he kind of substantiated the idea that male eels exist, real male eels. And he wrote his first professional paper on this, but he kind of downplayed it and ran away from it. And some people have, you know, have theories as to why this he ran away from it. but I think the truth of the matter is that he's a 20-year-old kid scientist, and he found something that kind of disproved his advisor's theory and Darwin's theory, and that was probably politically incorrect at that time. So he didn't put this paper on his resume. he kind of ran from it and never went back to eels, but he got his start in eels.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing story. Yeah. A last question of a more biological or anatomical nature before we dig into the crime stuff in our last portion. One of the most interesting chapters, I think, of your book is Chapter 8, called Shape Shifters. And this is when you help us understand the life cycle of the typical eel and the metamorphosis that they undergo in the various stages of life of the eel. And this is actually important for us to have at least a basic understanding of when it comes to kind of understanding so many other aspects of the story of the eel. Can you just sketch for our listeners, even just briefly, what I'm talking about here?
Are we talking about the life cycle of the eel from the Sargasso Sea?
You talk about leaving, they enter and leave five distinct anatomical stages, and each one, and I'm not sure, I think you might be talking about Atlantic eels here, but I suspect some of this is applicable to just about every kind of eel.
Well, definitely to the three commercially viable eels. So sure. It is fascinating. I'm interested that you're interested in that. The eel starts out life after it's spawned in the what we think is the Sargasso Sea. The Sargasso Sea is a very strange place. It's the only sea in the world that's bounded by currents and not by land masses. So the eel is weird, and where it's born is weird, okay? It's a fertilized egg, and then it becomes a larva, an eel larva, so that is the first stage. And the larva looks like a willow leaf. It doesn't look like an eel at all. When scientists first saw eel larva, they didn't think it was an eel, okay? It looks really like a tiny little willow leaf. This willow leaf finds its way in the current, North Atlantic current, and also propels itself. In the case of the American eel, it propels itself over 1,000 miles. In the case of, you know, the main eels that I'm writing about, up the coast of the, you know, eastern United States. And as it kind of reaches the continental shelf, the larva changes into a glass eel, which starts to look eel-like. So the larva can be as large as 5 inches long. Their eel larva can be quite big. The glass eel is smaller. It's about 3 inches. It kind of looks like a bloated toothpick. It's transparent. It's kind of charming in its own way. And then as it crosses the continental shelf and comes into the shore, estuaries, river heads, and things like that, it changes again to what is called an elver, okay? So it's pigmented. It's still really small. And then it, in some cases, it stays there. Most males, eels that become male, kind of stay there. And others swim up into the streams and the rivers to land in lakes, ponds, and, you know, can go all the way to Lake Superior in Wisconsin. These tend to be females, and they can hang there for up to 50 years before becoming, first they become yellow eels, and yellow eels are just like eating machines. They just spend their life eating. And then when they change again, and no one knows how they know when this is going to happen, they change to silver eels. They stop eating. They never eat again in their life. And they turn around and go back down the river and stream to the ocean, over the continental shelf, all the way back to the Sargasso Sea, where they spawn once or maybe twice, we're not sure, and die. That's the life cycle of the eel, and you can see why it's such a mystery.
Oh, it's incredible. You've touched, I think, already on the fact that eels are not easily bred in captivity. They don't like to breed in a farm setting, if you will, or in a laboratory setting. And so this has made, you know, certain practices almost necessary if one wants to have lots and lots and lots of eels to satisfy what is now the escalating demand for eels, both here and abroad. So explain the network of eel smuggling and eel poaching that has emerged recently, even as in as seemingly idyllic a place as the beautiful state of Maine.
Yeah. So well put, Mark, I have to say. That is true. Okay, so we talked about the decline of the European and the Japanese eel. Those two eels have experienced a radical decline, and they're highly, highly regulated. So you cannot export European eel out of the European Union anymore. It's illegal. It does happen, but it's illegal. And that has put a lot of pressure on the American eel for especially the Japanese market, the Asian market, and increased the price. Okay, so since this happened, the price of baby eels has gone through the roof. And we say baby eels because you're absolutely right. You cannot breed eels in captivity. It is impossible. There's a gentleman, a wonderful scientist in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, who managed to breed an American eel briefly in his laboratory, but the larva died. The American eel and the European eel both resist captive reproduction. They won't do it. So all that we can do to grow eel is to grow bigger eels from baby eels, the elvers or the glass eels that I mentioned earlier. And supply chain for this is, I think, crazy. So the way it works is we catch, fishermen catch elvers or glass eels off the coast of Maine, for example. It's only one of two states where it's legal to catch elvers, the other one being South Carolina. That's a tiny, tiny fishery. So the main fishery in the United States is in Maine. Catch these tiny little creatures off the coast of Maine. They're bought by dealers, and then they're shipped to Asia, where they're grown up on eel farms in China. Once they're grown up to anywhere from a half a pound to a pound and a half, they're slaughtered, they're turned into fillets, they're frozen, and they're shipped back to the United States. So these are Maine eels, but they're grown up in China. And there's so many problems with this, not the least of them being environmental problems, nor are there real controls over what those ponds, look like in China. But that is the way the system is right now. So our cultivated eels almost are entirely coming from China.
So how is it that so much of the harvesting of eels has happened in this sort of black market environment? I mean, why has this been such a fertile ground for that sort of activity?
Well, it wasn't until about 2011, 2012 when the price of eel went through the roof. And the same cartels that deal in drugs or deal in guns have gotten involved in the eel trade. So the illegal trade of baby eels is now the biggest wildlife crime on the planet. It's about $4 billion a year because these creatures are so valuable. So we're talking really big money here. And as I said, most of the market for this in terms of growing up the eel is in China. And it's very, very difficult to control. Interpol's involved, Europol's involved, American federal agencies are involved. And the case that I talk about in the book in Maine, of course, with the U.S. federal agencies were involved in cracking that poaching ring.
Right.
But they're all over the world.
And you quote an official involved in kind of the enforcement side of things saying that they were absolutely flabbergasted by the sudden skyrocket of prices for eels. I mean, this was not on the horizon, if you will, and that's one reason why some of this nefarious activity was allowed to go on for a time, and in a sense, law enforcement had to catch up with it. We just have a couple minutes left, but I want to give you a chance to talk about your memorable encounter with someone who kind of came to be known as the Kingpin. That might even be, that's the title of the chapter in which you talk about your encounter with one Bill Sheldon, who ultimately went to prison for some of what he engaged in the eel industry. Tell us what you learned from him.
Well, at the time, William Sheldon was a 73-year-old grandfather, okay? And when we met, he was only 2 months out of the federal penitentiary, where he'd spent 6 months after having been convicted as being the kingpin of an eel poaching ring that involved 8 states up and down the eastern seaboard. Okay? So this involved a federal investigation that went on for years called Operation Broken Glass, as in glass eels, right? So Operation Broken Glass, and he was a kingpin in this poaching ring that involved 110 arrests and 22 people going to prison, okay? And Bill Sheldon was an expert on eels. He had a degree in wildlife management. He was really known in Maine as being the expert on eels in the state, buying and selling and preservation of eels. And he was the biggest eel dealer in Maine as well. He still is, by the way. He lost his fishing license when he got arrested. He was also fined. They also took his truck that had the license plate Eel Wagon on it. But he was able to keep his fishing license, and he still deals eels through a company that he works for. You know, he was, again, quite a slippery guy, and that sting was huge.
Incredible. And, of course, we can read all about it in riveting detail in your book. So tell us in our last minute and a half or so about the way in which the picture perhaps is changing with the recent opening of a commercially viable eel farm right in the United States.
Yes, the first commercially viable eel farm in the U.S. Opened in 2023, just last year. It's a $12 million facility, again, in Midcoast, Maine, only 10 miles from my house in Maine, in fact. It's run by, was founded by an aquaculture expert by the name of Sarah Rademacher, who's actually from Indiana. And she was very, intrigued by Maine, adopted the state, and started this facility with a lot of public support, investor support. So her idea is to truncate that crazy supply chain and have eels that are fished in Maine, baby eels, grown up in Maine, to keep the value in Maine and to employ people in Maine. This is where the economics of this story comes into place, this regional development, regional employment, right? She's trying to shorten that supply chain, and so far she's been quite successful. And her goal is to have about 6 or 7% of the nation's consumption of eels coming from her eel farm in Waldoboro, Maine.
A fascinating story that we will follow with interest. And in the meantime, we have really just scratched the surface of your fascinating book about the eel and its many, many mysteries. Towards the end of the book, you write, "For centuries, people of every rank strove to peel back the layers of the eel's strangeness. Their revelations were and are relative. We do not know everything about the eel, but thanks to these indomitable seekers, we understand so much more than we otherwise would. And not only about the eel. I believe it is not just the eel's riddles that matter, but the unstoppable human drive to interrogate our world." The book, again, is Slippery Beast, A True Crime Natural History with Eels, published by Abrams Press, the author Ellen Ruppelschell. Ellen Ruppelschell, thank you for giving the world this fascinating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. I was really pleased to be able to speak with you.
Thank you. You did it was wonderful to have the opportunity to reflect on this with you. So thank you.
Now, 8:59, Monday, August 26th. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Wisconsin Public Radio News, also your gateway to public radio. I'm Dave McGrath. Quick check on the forecast, kind of important you know this today, a heat advisory for this afternoon and tonight. It'll be mostly sunny. We've got a cloud cover now. That'll clear up. Mostly sunny, very hot and humid. Today's high 93, the heat index near 108 later today. Already 82 degrees now for both Racine and Kenosha. As we come up on 9 o'clock, Wisconsin Today from Wisconsin Public Radio up shortly.